Philip Bromberg passed away this week, and I thought it would be a fitting way to honor his memory to discuss one of his classic papers, Standing in the Spaces. Some of you will be familiar with it, and we have discussed it in the past, but with a much smaller group. So I thought it would be nice to try to talk about it with this larger group and look at some of the ways in which his theories, particularly of self-states, dovetail with some Buddhist ideas about the self and how we work with those in our practice, both a psychotherapy practice and a Zazen practice. See, last week we talked about a view of the mind from the perspective of Koichi Togashi that in some ways was very familiar and conventional in that he talked about a kind of vertically organized self. In the sense that many of us often think about the self in terms of a social self, a part of ourselves that we show to others, or that is engaged in relationship and in activity, but that in addition to this, there is our inner self, which is how we feel to ourselves, an inner subjective self that is somehow underlying this outer relational social self. And in that model, it's easy to think of the outer self as accommodative or a false self, and the true self being what's deep inside, the part that nobody gets to see. And we call that the real me. And that can have all sorts of consequences, both in terms of psychology and in terms of practice. From a therapeutic point of view, too often the part we never show anyone is the parts that we are most ashamed of. And the unfortunate consequence of this is that the parts we bury, we come to think of as the real me. And the real me becomes something that no one is allowed to see, and I don't even want to admit to myself. On the other hand, from a Buddhist practice point of view, you can imagine that a true self or Buddha nature is a kind of hidden kernel of enlightenment. Something that is ordinarily buried under ego, under habit, under thought, under emotion, and that the business of practice is to continually try to strip away or penetrate these outer layers to get to the true core, your original face, not the face that everyone sees. And as we discussed last time, Togashi had a picture of emptiness being the true self that is under the social accommodative self. And out of that can flow a kind of spontaneous or compassionate responsiveness. But only when we've cut through the outer shells. So this kind of vertical model of the self in some ways is quite familiar across a lot of disciplines and cultures. And it's this model that I think is what's challenged by Bromberg and other contemporary relational theorists. But it also dovetails with a particular view of the self that we can have in Zen. And that's a picture of the self that's organized horizontally rather than vertically. So rather than feeling that there's an outer me and a real inner me, what we look at instead as all the shifts in moment-to-moment experience that occur. Who am I in this situation? Who am I in that relationship? Who am I in this moment? Who am I in the next moment? And when we arrange things like this horizontally, it's like the setup we see in a Zoom meeting like this, right? Where there may be 50 little pictures scattered across a couple pages, and then there's one big picture at the center. And that's sort of the one I'm mostly being, say, as I'm speaking. But I have the potential to switch into any one of these other squares, which can represent all sorts of different sides to myself or different relationships. And there's no particular way to create a hierarchy among those 50 different selves or pictures. Each one comes to the foreground in its own turn, plays its role, and then goes back into the background. And no one of them gets to claim that they are the real me or my true self. Each is a different aspect. Each has its own ways of thinking about itself, thinking about others, its own motivations, its own strengths, its own weaknesses. Now, the word that Bromberg uses for the way we keep each one of these different selves within its own square is dissociation. And when one comes to the foreground, the others are in the background. And by and large, we need to keep these squares separate. And we can think of that in very simple terms, like how do I behave towards my mother versus how do I behave towards my child or to my partner or to a stranger on the street. In each one of these different situations, a different side of me is appropriately called into the foreground. And there'd be something wrong if those different relationships were blurred or mixed up, right? So that's a kind of healthy dissociation that keeps roles and boundaries distinct. But Bromberg also describes ways in which dissociation functions more pathologically. And that's where some aspects of the self become very intolerant of others. And there's a good deal of either jostling for position, mutual criticism of one part of the other, or in more extreme cases, a kind of complete denial by one part that the other parts exist. And we can think of that as the kind of things that happen when I get sort of very invested in being an authority or an expert. And I might be very ashamed of the part of me that is caught out not knowing something, or the part that is not autonomous but is dependent. The part of me that wants to feel independent may be contemptuous of the part of me that actually has needs for companionship and gets lonely, gets frightened. I might want to pretend to everybody and to myself that those parts of myself don't exist, or they're not the real me, or that if I just practice a little longer, I can make them disappear once and for all. So we might think of Bromberg's model of these horizontal self states in a kind of uncomfortable form of coexistence as a kind of ongoing game of musical chairs, where at any given moment when the music stops, there's not enough chairs to go around for the number of self-states we've got. That we're always in this position of feeling like there are some aspects that are extra or wrong or shameful that don't fit in the circle we're trying to create, the picture we're trying to maintain of all my good self states. There's always the danger that one of the bad ones, the shameful ones, is going to try to force itself into the picture. And so we're in the position of trying to constantly shuttle one part of ourself off stage. And the consequences can be severe, both in terms of how we treat ourselves and how we treat others. Because if we despise our own neediness or vulnerability, one of the ways we might try to get rid of that aspect of ourselves is to project it onto somebody else. We can always act strong and independent. But you're emotional and dependent and really don't have your act together. And I'm going to put you in the permanent student, patient position, and you're never going to get out of that because I need you to stay there in order so that I can feel like I don't have any of that in myself, right? Now, there are lots of different aspects to that paper that perhaps we'll get into during the discussion. But one more we might address is the way he sees this resolving itself, which is not that all these different self-states somehow come to a harmonious unity. It's not as if one day we're going to be able to integrate all these different selves into one cohesive, coherent self that we can take into any situation, right? That's a certain kind of fantasy that we would have, say, about an enlightened person who could just be themselves in any situation whatsoever, right? And they'd be the same self that's together and equanimous and cheerful and whatever attribute you have. But that self simply could go into any situation, no matter who it's with or what's going on, and stay the same, regardless of circumstance or context or relationship. And so part of what this picture does is try to dispel that myth of perfect cohesion or perfect unity, and says that rather what we have to come to terms with is the inevitability of conflict, that these different self states are going to have different motivational agendas, and that they all have to be recognized and respected without suddenly getting them back into some kind of hierarchy, including the hierarchy of health and illness. So one of the things he would say is that if we have a part of ourselves that is very adventurous or outgoing and novelty seeking, we might like to think of that as our healthy, good self, and the self that is afraid or shy or has been really embarrassed in the past publicly and is reluctant to go into social situations or speak in public or try new things. We might be inclined to label that as a neurotic self, and we want to somehow get rid of it or minimize it and say, well, why can't that part be more like the other, right? And one of the things he wants to do is, in a sense, have a kind of self-state neutrality, a kind of empathy for each state that legitimizes the need of each one on its own terms. So if you've been really humiliated or traumatized in the past, he would say the need to protect yourself is as completely legitimate as the need to want to be outgoing and to be expansive or novel. That both of these are completely legitimate psychological needs, and they're incommensurate with each other. And you can't, and the analyst has no godlike position to stand on to say what's the proper balance or resolution between these two positions. That's something that these are parts of your history and your personality, which will always be in some kind of conflict. And the point is to try to hold and recognize the conflict, not resolve it by having one completely dominate or eliminate the other. So that's a kind of position of empathy into all these self states that tries to give them a certain kind of equal legitimacy, to allow each in turn to, instead of a situation where we play musical chairs with ourselves and one self has to get discarded when the music stops, the goal is much more to bring in an extra chair, to find room at the table for all these different self states, so that they all have a place, rather than any one of them being in a position to be discarded. And I think some of you might recognize a kind of parallel with the ideas of Isaiah Berlin that we've also studied around the notion of value pluralism. Berlin said that too often in the past, philosophers have gone astray when they thought that the goods that we seek in life or the virtues we try to cultivate in ourselves should all somehow be able to be integrated into a seamless whole. His point was that goods may be incompatible and conflicting, and that there is no calculus or place to stand to say what's the right kind of balance to strike between competing goods, that that's going to be an irreducible political decision, not a philosophical problem that's going to be solved in the abstract of how all these things are supposed to be put together. You know, and he would use the example from Machiavelli's Prince, where he says you can pursue the warlike ideals of Homeric Greece, or you can pursue the Christian virtues of charity and humility, but you can't pursue them at the same time, and they contradict each other. They are different value systems, and that there's no simple way to just have a little of this and a little of that and come to the proper mix. There's going to have to be a choice about what kind of system do you want to have. And again, there's no God's eye position to take that says which is the better system that everybody should subscribe to. So Berlin talked about value pluralism. And there the overarching goal is, again, like the idea of adding extra chairs to the table. The point is not to have one set of values trump every other, but to find a way to respect and acknowledge that there are going to be competing goods that we have to deal with. I think that a good example of that that's playing out in everyone's lives right now has to do with the decisions being made about when to open up the cities after the lockdown that we've been going through. On one hand, you could say, if your priority is to minimize the risk of future people dying from the disease, you want the lockdown to go as long as possible. You want to keep everybody in a safe position where they can't infect anyone else until cases go to zero, or until we have an absolutely perfect vaccine. That will minimize the deaths. On the other hand, somebody would say, well, what's the social or economic cost of everybody staying in lockdown? And how are you going to do that? Who's going to feed them? Who's going to pick up the garbage? Is somebody going to man the fire trucks? How do you decide who's exempt from that lockdown because they're basic or essential services that have to keep going? When do you send kids back to school? Well, you could keep them out of school until there are no more cases, but Can you do that for 3 months? Can you do it for a year? Could you do it for 2 years if there wasn't a vaccine? And somebody would say, but you're putting the children at risk. How many deaths are worth it to get the schools running again? And there's no answer to that. The goods are competing and incommensurable. There is no utilitarian calculus that says how many deaths of children is it worth risking in order to restore an education system for the vast majority of other children. We have no, there is not a, no possible such utilitarian calculus. These are incommensurable and competing goods, and people will necessarily work out their own kind of compromise of what seems like the right answer. And so in Bromberg's world, that's the kind of thing that's going on inside us all the time, where we have competing self-states with different motivational systems and different values, all trying to work out a modus vivendi with each other. And we might say that one other important aspect of his picture of this is that it's going on in the analyst at the same time it's going on in the patient. And that that's a good thing, not a bad thing. See, this exists in contrast, say, to Kohut's theory, where the ideal functioning analyst is primarily or almost exclusively in a mode of empathic inquiry, that the analyst is own subjectivity is bracketed to the extent that his job is to stay empathically attuned with what's going on in the patient. And he was most concerned about the way the analyst's personality would intrude or interrupt his capacity for empathy. But Bromberg says that in fact, one of the ways the patient comes to tolerate and even understand the existence of different aspects of themselves is to begin to recognize different sides and aspects in the analyst. So that if the analyst or the Zen teacher is always perceived in this purely idealized mode of all good, all understanding, never having any needs of their own, what that can foster in the patient or the student is a sense that any deviation from that kind of perfection in themselves is a flaw that they still have not yet managed to overcome. And it's only when there's a recognition and tolerance of different sides of the analyst that the student or the patient comes to some kind of tolerance of multiple sides of themselves. Well, there's a lot more we could say about that paper, but I think I've talked long enough for today, and we can discuss it further in the discussion group.